First of all, let me thank the organizers for inviting me to this nice conference. I want to tell you about some work in progress I've been doing lately with Bartaz and Pellegrini. But before doing so, I also want to review some results I derived a few years ago with these gentlemen here, some of whom are in the audience. This crowd make up the irreverent violators of my title. And also, I'm going to talk to focus on large classical violations of the null energy condition, which, as you recall, has been referred to as non-existent yesterday by Tammy, so I guess I'm done. Thank you. Anyway, so what are the energy conditions in GR? Great. It's not working. Yes. Energy conditions in GR are basically the statement that energy is positive, but that's obviously a too loose statement for the level of sophistication of GR. Okay, we need some more refined version of the statement, and there are several ways of making it more refined. Okay, and correspondingly, there are several inequivalent energy conditions under the name of weak, strong, dominant, null energy condition, and perhaps a few more that I'm not recalling right now. And basically, they correspond to different contractions of the stress energy tensor, because energy in GR, or energy density in GR, is just part of a more interesting object, the stress energy tensor, and depending on how you choose to define positive stress energy tensor, you end up with different energy conditions. Now, why are they important? Well, they're usually assumptions and theorems that, for GR, allow us to prove things that we like about GR, for instance, the absence of closed timeline curves starting from nice initial conditions, asymptotically flat initial conditions. Okay. They allow us to prove the positive energy theorem, so the statement that in asymptotically flat space, energy is positive, and the only state with zero energy is the vacuum itself with flat metric. And for instance, they allow us to prove the second law of black hole thermodynamics, okay, which is important. They tell us that in the dynamics of a system of black holes and other stuff, the area of the black holes is always going to increase, and so we can assign an entropy to the area. Okay? Now, unfortunately, the same energy conditions also enter in things we don't like about GR, most notably the singularities. Okay? Energy conditions are assumptions that allow us to prove the singularity theorems. Okay? But in a way, they are crucial ingredient of their relativity. Now, I want to stress here that they are assumptions, okay? They are assumptions in theorems, and the obvious question is, how reasonable are these assumptions? No, it's not bad, it's not bad. And perhaps you like it. I mean, it's cool, fine, yeah. Well, it's bad in a sense, I'll tell you in a second. Anyway, so are these reasonable assumptions? So if you want more precisely, are the energy conditions obeyed by all well-behaved physical systems? That's the question, right? And I want to argue that the best candidate for such an energy condition is the null one, the null energy condition. I want to argue that it's the most robust, and therefore, for me at least, in my opinion, the most worthwhile investigating. Okay? So first of all, let me state it. It's just a statement that if I take any null vector and mu, and I contract the T mu nu this way, okay, what I get is positive or zero, at least. Why is this the nicest, in my opinion? Because it's saturated by a cosmological constant. Okay, so if you take a T mu nu proportional to the metric, this gives you zero. Which means that you cannot screw with it by adding a suitable cosmological constant. Whereas all the other energy conditions, you can violate them by taking a standard physical system, let's say more relativistic matter, and add a very large negative cosmological constant, or vice versa. If you have a very bad system with very negative energies, you can fix the other energy conditions by adding a suitable large positive cosmological constant. So all the others are somehow ambiguous. Okay? Ambiguous in the following sense. You could say a usual objection to this logic is saying, okay, but they should be obeyed, but the non-cosmological part of the TMU. But locally, it's ambiguous what the cosmological part of the TMU. The whole point of energy conditions is giving local conditions of the stress energy on the stress energy tensor. Whereas by looking at the entries of the stress energy tensor, locally, I cannot decide what's cosmological constant and what's not. Okay? So I want to focus on the null energy condition. Now, let me just stress that the null energy condition is closely related to the dominant energy condition, okay, which essentially is just the null energy condition supplemented by the requirement that the energy density be positive. Okay? This is the case, for instance, for an isotropic system like a cosmological system. More covariantly, the dominant energy condition is the statement that if you take any time-like future-directed vector u mu, and you contract the t mu mu this way, what you get is a vector which is also time-like and future-directed. Why is this an interesting condition to impose? Well, it's the statement, if you interpret u mu as the four velocity of any observer, okay, it's the statement that that observer will never measure a flux, a superluminal flux of energy momentum, because t mu nu contracted with its four velocity is exactly the measured flux of energy momentum for that observer. Okay? I put a sim here because, as usual, there is a cosmological constant ambiguity in the sense that if I add a negative cosmological constant to a null energy condition preserving system, I can violate the dominant energy condition. And so formally, I can have some superluminal flow of energy momentum. But that's a fake because it's not a fluctuating thing. Okay, I cannot propagate signals, for instance. It's just that the negative cosmological constant is some crazy object from this point of view, but fluctuations on top of this system will not propagate superluminal. Okay? But I want to stress. Well, no, no, this gives me a P, sorry, this gives me a vector P, let me call it P mu, which is the density of four momentum. And if that's not time-like and future-directed, it means that the energy momentum technically is flowing outside the light cone, okay? Anyway, so I just wanted to stress the connection with superluminality because it's coming over and over again, okay? So, for cosmology, for a cosmological system, the null energy condition implies that rho plus p is positive, okay? Now, in a flat FRW universe, rho plus p enters in determining h dot, okay? H dot goes like minus rho plus p, okay? So the null energy condition implies that h dot is always negative. So if the null energy condition is satisfied, h dot is always negative or at most zero, okay? And this raises a number of issues, and if you want answering to your question, it raises, first of all, an issue about, it's purely, it's not a scientific issue, it's a psychological question. So if H always wants to decrease, why is the universe expanding in the first place, okay? The mystery of expansion in a field theory that cannot violate an energy condition is a non-mystery in the sense that it's tied to initial conditions that you cannot control. If you follow the evolution of our universe back in time and you assume that the null energy condition is satisfied everywhere, H dot is negative, so H has to increase back in time. At some point you reach a region of very high curvatures, and there, from the low energy effective field theory viewpoint, you're just imposing some initial conditions, and hopefully this will be given to you by the recompletion of gravity, okay? But you see, to answer your question, Aldo, that here the singularity theorem is, in a sense, telling you that you cannot proceed without the recompletion of gravity. You don't know the full, I mean, There's no. You can have an initial condition, but it's you don't have a full consistent story within quantum field theory coupled to general relativity. Understanding.
In string theory, you're stuck. Okay.
Well, I mean, suppose the no boundary proposal is right and makes sense and is well defined.
just for a moment.
Anyway, so it's also important, as I was mentioning earlier, it's also important, for instance, for black hole physics, because, I mean, the energy condition or the dominant energy condition, as I said, are closely related, and they imply the second law of thermodynamics of black holes, simply meaning if you throw positive energy stuff into a black hole, its mass is going to increase, so its area is going to increase, whereas if you were able to violate the energy condition and throw negative energy stuff into a black hole, you could make it shrink, okay? So the growth of area of the black hole horizon area is closely related to the dominant energy condition, okay? And of course, the second law is crucial for the thermodynamic interpretation of black holes and for the holographic assignment of degrees of freedom to the in an amount proportional to the area of the horizon. Now, you may notice that the careful wording of my slide here allows me to be tangent to the topic of the conference. And now, like other speakers before me, now let me move away again. So, okay, so the question I want to ask is the following. Can we construct a sensible quantum field theory, quantum effective field theory? It's not going to be renormalizable, but at least can we make sense of it as an effective field theory that does violate the non-energy condition, okay? And it's difficult, okay? It's difficult because usually a violation of the non-energy condition implies instabilities, okay? And so if you require stability of the solution you're talking about, your solution automatically preserves the non-energy, obeys the non-energy condition, okay? And this is most easily seen in the simplest possible example. Take a scalar field with a standard kinetic term and a potential, and allow me to leave the sign of the kinetic energy free for the moment, okay, to study this connection between stability and energy condition. Now, if I take a cosmological solution, say, so phi is a function of t, rho plus p turns out to be phi dot square with exactly the same sign as that appearing here, okay? So if rho plus p is positive and you obey the non-energy condition, the kinetic energy of your field is positive and the system is stable. Vice versa, if you violate the non-energy condition, you are plagued by ghost-like instabilities which are as fast as the cutoff of your field, okay? Now, of course, this is a trivial example, and what I want to do is make sense, is qualify this usually, okay? Understand how usual and unavoidable this is, okay? Now, I will do this without gravity. So I will focus, for instance, on distances much shorter than the horizon, etc. And without gravity, this is a perfectly well-defined quantum field theory question because we don't need GR to talk about conditions on the stress-energy tensor. The stress-energy tensor is defined once we are given the Lagrangian of our field. And whatever we get here, once we introduce gravity, this will translate into some Einstein frame statement. I make this comment because if you have a scalar tensor theory, there are usually the confusion about Einstein frame, Jordan frame. Perhaps it can look like you violate an energy condition in one frame, but you're not violating it in the other, etc. Okay, so there you have a lot of ambiguities and possible apparent or real violations. The statement we will get here will be an Einstein frame statement. Okay? Now, there's a fact that to violate the null energy condition, you need to break spontaneously Lorentz invariance. And it's trivial because if you don't spontaneously break Lorentz invariance, if your solution is Lorentz preserving, the stress energy tensor is going to be proportional to the metric, and the metric saturates the null energy condition. So apart from some space-time dependent that you can have in a coefficient here, the tensor structure is such that it saturates the null energy condition. So you need a solution that spontaneously breaks Lorentz invariance. And since you are spontaneously breaking a symmetry, even though it's a space-time symmetry, you have some Gostown bosons, okay, that are light. And as usual, the dynamics is largely dictated by symmetry considerations. So there's a lot of model independent features of the dynamics when you have Goldstone bosons. And so in a sense, they are a very robust ingredient of any solution that breaks, spontaneously breaks Lorentz invariant, and so any solution that violates the energy condition. And those are probably the guys you should worry about, okay? Because those are the most in the model independent features of your system. Yes, I'm not going to consider that. I'm not going to consider that. Yes. I don't know how to couple to gravity and explicitly Lorentz violating theory, so I'm not sure I can make sense of it. Yeah. It's explicit, but it's also not clear it's fully consistent, right? There are claims that, yeah, so, yeah. I have nothing to say about that. Well, but the dynamics is going to be different, right? Because if it's explicit, you don't have Goldstones. Whereas if it's spontaneous, you have Goldstones. So it's really explicit versus spontaneous is a statement about the low energy degrees of freedom. So it's a physical difference.
We write the model as a theory of spontaneously broken invariants, and this has been done in Hirschhoff Lipschitz. It's been written as a completely generally covariant theory coupled to an exotic form of matter similar to ghosts.
I'm not sure it's been done consistently.
Well, it's been done consistently, but the theory itself may not be consistent. Inconsistencies are the inconsistency isn't in the scope of our
where we talk about that later.
Okay, let me go. So let's try to be quite general.
Let's consider a system of scalars, okay? Of course, we can have more complicated systems, but let me focus on scalars. And in general, in a standard derivative expansion, we have a Lagrangian as a function of the fields, the derivatives, second derivatives, etc. Okay? And I and j here label the number of fields I have. Suppose I have n fields. Okay? Now, first of all, this is quite general because, for instance, it includes, I don't want to show this now, but I'm happy to talk about this later if you want. But this system includes any possible mixture of fluids and solids, because you can rewrite the Lagrangian for a solid or a fluid as an effective theory of three derivatively coupled scalars. Okay? So the system here includes scalar fields, fluids, solids, basically everything we care about in cosmology, for instance. Okay? Usually. Now, also, as usual, at low enough energies, if I want to have a consistent effective theories, it means that typically higher derivative corrections are unimportant, okay? And so I can stop at the lowest derivative level, okay? That gives me some non-trivial dynamics. And that's enough to see the Lorentz breaking we were talking about, because if I have some solution with a non-trivial d mu phi, that's a spontaneous breaking of Lorentz invariants, okay? So stopping at this level is enough for our purposes. So let me stop at the first derivative level in the Lagrangian. So the Lagrangian is going to be a function of the fields and the first derivatives. Now, first derivatives carry indices. These indices have to be contracted, okay? And so, in fact, it's a function of the fields and these meson fields, Bij, which is simply the contraction of the derivatives with some dependence on the two fields you are talking about, I and J, okay? Now, suppose you have you're studying some Lorentz breaking solution because that's what you want to violate the energy condition. So you have some non-trivial solution with a non-trivial d mu phi for some I. And the stress energy tensor of this solution is related to derivatives of the Lagrangian with respect to the metric. So the metric, first of all, appears in the square root of g, but that gives me a term in the stress energy tensor proportional to g mu nu, which, as I argued, I don't care about for the null energy condition. So let me forget about that, okay? And the metric also appears here in Bij, in this contraction. Okay? So the metric, the stress energy tensor, is basically the derivative of F with respect to Bij, which I call Fij, the derivative of F with respect to B, okay, times whatever is multiplying the metric here, which is d mu phi I, d mu phi j. Okay? Fine. Now I study the kinetic action for small fluctuations. That is, I perturb my solution slightly by some small perturbation, pi I. Okay? And the quadratic action for fluctuations is going to be related to derivatives of F with respect to the fields, their first derivatives, and also there's going to be some dependence on the second derivatives of F with respect to the fields and their derivatives, because I'm expanding Lagrange at second order. Okay? So if you carry out the algebra, which is really straightforward, is this. You have first derivatives with respect to Bij plus second derivative with respect to Bij multiplying the background solutions. Okay? So that's the kinetic action for small fluctuations. And of course, I'm going to have some mass terms coming from the explicit dependence on the fields rather than on the derivatives. Okay? But let's look just at the kinetic action. Okay? So you have this and this. No. Okay. So if this term were not there, okay, you see that I have a very direct connection between the kinetic action for small fluctuations and the Timurian. And you can convince yourself very easily that if you take the contraction that here defines the null energy condition, okay, and impose that, for instance, you violate the null energy condition, okay, since it's the same matrix, Fij, Fij appearing here and here, the positivity properties of the Timurian are one-to-one correspondence to the positivity properties of the kinetic Lagrangian for fluctuations, okay? But of course, everything is complicated by this second order thing, okay? The second derivatives of F with respect to the derivatives of the fields times the background solution, okay? And this complicates things. And the complete, carry out the analysis without any assumption about these tensors, these matrices, okay? And the complete analysis involves a fair amount of pain, okay? But you can carry it out. And you come to the following result, very general result, that if you assume that the solution you're talking about is stable and either it has an isotropic stress energy tensor, like in cosmology, or fluctuations are subluminal, or at most luminal, okay? Then the null energy condition is satisfied. Okay, there's no way out at the level we are working at. Okay, there's no way out. So stability plus either of these two requirements. Conversely, if you remove the right amount of requirements, you can, yes, stability, I mean positivity of the kinetic energy. That's what I mean. Okay? It's a perturbative stability of the system. Perturbative stability of the system. Of course, I mean, if you have negative energies in your field space, there's going to be some probably bubble-like non-perturbative process that drives you somewhere else. But I care about the perturbative stability of the solutions. Yeah. Exactly, that complicates the analysis. So that's been taken into account, okay? That's been taken into account. By stability, I mean that since the background is Lorentz violating, I mean that there is a Lorentz frame in which the observer sees a positive definite Hamiltonian, which is not, I mean, seeing a positive definite Hamiltonian, as you're saying, is not a Lorentz invariant statement, but at least the system is stable if there is at least one observer who sees a positive definite Hamiltonian, okay? So that's what complicates the analysis also. Okay? Anyway, so if you remove enough assumptions, you can find sort of sensible systems, solutions that do violate the null energy condition. In particular, so you have to remove, if you want stability, you have to remove both the two extra assumptions, which is to say If you want a stable solution that violates the non-energy condition, it's going to have an anisotropic stress energy tensor, and fluctuations are going to be superluminal. Okay? Now we can question, we can discuss whether superluminality is a problem or not, but for sure, a stress energy tensor with strong anisotropies is not going to be useful to construct interesting non-standard cosmological solutions. Okay? So even order one. Sorry? No, it's not really. We can talk about the details later, but it's really it's sort of having a if you want, you cannot diagonalize the stress energy tensor. You have a flow of momentum. Okay, you have the off diagonal terms that are so large that they beat the diagonal ones, and there is no Lorentz transformation that make you diagonalize the stress energy tension. So it's really anisotropic by order one, in the sense that there's no frame in which it's isotropic. Sorry?
Well, then I guess that will also, so your non-energy condition violating effect will also average to zero large scales.
Because
you see, it's really the stress energy tensor that is entering, that is both anisotropic and it's violating the non-energy condition. So, perhaps there is some way out. Okay. Anyway, another feature is that these explicit examples have superluminal acceptations, and there's no way out because of this. Now we have another theorem. So, as usual, for theorems, if you want to evade the conclusions, you want to find a way to evade the assumptions. Okay? So let's go back to the statement, to the definition of our system, and see what the assumptions were. Okay? So a few slides ago, there was this slide. And so we consider a system of scalars, this Lagrangian, we have these properties. Okay? What are the assumptions here? Well, the first assumption is that we are considering scalars. And as I argued, it's fairly general in the sense that it also includes cosmic fluids, solids, if you're interested in solids. Of course, it doesn't include true vectors, tensors, etc. Now, we never tried to extend the analysis to higher spin fields, okay? My feeling is that it's not going to solve any problem because working with scalars is also nice because they give you a lot of freedom, okay? Whereas coming up with consistent effective theories of vectors and tensors is a pain, okay? There's many more constraints. So it's going to be a much more constrained Lagrangian, the one you're going to write down. But I have no particular precise statement to say about it, okay? So I'm not going to relax the scalar assumption. The other assumption here is that at low energies, we can focus on the lowest derivative Lagrangian. Okay? Now, why do we think it's a sensible assumption usually? Well, usually it's a sensible assumption because, first of all, the terms with the least number, the lowest number of derivatives are the most relevant at low energies. Okay? And also because, perhaps more importantly, when higher derivative corrections become important, it's a problem. It's a problem both at the classical level, because if you don't bother to worry about quantum effects, but you just look at the classical equations of motion, at the classical level, you see that higher derivative corrections always imply the presence of other degrees of freedom with negative kinetic energy, with ghosts, okay? And in particular, when these become important, it means that you're going at energies of order of the mass of this guy with negative kinetic energy, and so there is no sense in which you can neglect it, okay? You are exciting. So classically, it's a problem because equations of motion are not second order, and higher order equations of motion are problematic. Quantum mechanically,
This usually implies, when higher derivatives become important, usually implies a breakdown of the effective theory of the derivative expansion, okay? Because if the first term, higher derivative term become important, it means that also all the subsequent ones are going to become to be important, okay? So there is no derivative expansion. The effective field theory breaks down, and it's also what saves you from this paradox here, okay? Because the presence of this ghost is not a robust feature of the theory, it's a totally UV-dependent question, okay? Now, is there a caveat in this logic? Well, there's actually two caveats, okay? And I'm going to talk about them. And these two caveats lead us to two interesting effective theories that do violate the null energy condition without instability. So the first caveat leads to the ghost condensate, which Paolo talked about yesterday. And the ghost condensate is a model originally proposed by these people for modifying gravity at large distances. But let's forget about the modification of gravity it induces. Let's just discuss its properties for violating the null energy condition. So the caveat is the following. Suppose that at lowest derivative level, the system is degenerate. Degenerate in spatial derivatives. That is to say that the quadratic action for small fluctuations about the solution we are talking about, remember we are always talking about some particular solution and we are expanding for small fluctuations. Small fluctuations have a quadratic Lagrangian whose gradient energy is zero or nearly so. It's very small, okay? So this of course is a Lorentz breaking statement, but since the solution we are talking about spontaneously breaks Lorentz invariant, there's no contradiction, okay? So in this case, this is the limit Paolo was referring to yesterday as the small speed of sound limit, okay? We can take the speed of sound to go to zero. In this case, consider higher derivative terms in terms of the original field, the field, the Lorentz invariant field phi that eventually is going to give us a Lorentz violating solution and whose fluctuations we are interested in, okay? So if we consider, let's say, a Lorentz invariant object like this, box phi squared, and we expand it in small fluctuations, so phi equals phi solution plus phi, okay? This is going to generate these terms, terms with the second time derivatives, mixed derivatives, upon integration by parts, and the second special derivatives, okay? Sorry. So this is Lagrangian for small fluctuations. So I'm assuming that I have a Lorentz invariant Lagrangian for this guy phi. I'm assuming that the Lagrangian is producing a Lorentz breaking solution, okay, which is fine. And I'm expanding for small fluctuations about that solution. Yes, exactly, okay? Yeah, I'm not going through the derivation of the solution because I was, for what I'm going to say is not relevant. I just want to understand the most generic features of perturbations of a Lorentz invariant theory around Lorentz violating solutions, okay? So higher derivative terms will generate terms like this in terms of pi. And the first two terms are negligible at low energies. They're negligible because they're like this, but with more derivatives, okay? So each of them involves at least two time derivatives, and then there is extra stuff. So they're negligible at low energies. Whereas the other term is the leading source of gradient energy. It's the thing that is giving you propagating waves, okay? So the system at this order is degenerate, and it only has propagating waves when you include this, okay? So it's perfectly consistent to include higher, in a system like this, to include higher spatial derivatives while neglecting higher time derivatives. So this means, since the classical problem with the ghosts in higher derivative equations of motion is related to higher time derivatives, okay? This means that there is a regime in this theory in which I can include consistently higher derivative terms without breaking down the effective theory. That is to say, without introducing any ghost degrees of freedom, without having to assume that the derivative expansion breaks down. In particular, this system has a consistent derivative expansion with, of course, now a non-relativistic scaling because the operators that define marginality have different numbers of space and time derivatives, but it's a non-derivative, it's a, sorry, it's a non-relativistic derivative expansion. There's nothing wrong with it. And in this sense, it's similar to Ojala's case, but here it's spontaneous, the breakdown. As I said, there's no ghost-like new degree of freedom because higher time derivatives are negligible. And by using this, you can indeed construct interesting null energy condition violating cosmological solutions. Okay, and in particular, one is the quintessence model Paolo was talking about yesterday. You can have a phase with W less than minus one now with no instabilities and no pathologies, ineffective in theory. Okay, one is a system in which the universe contracts, then bounces, and then expands. And once again, the bounce is realized without the effect of the theory to break down, and you have no instabilities. Another is a model that we called, we dubbed starting the universe. It's a model in which you can start asymptotically in the past from Minkowski space, okay, H is zero, and then very smoothly, the universe has to expand. Okay, so A of T, if you want, starts from constant in the past, and then smoothly starts expanding. Okay, so it's pretty much like Robert's scenario on Thursday, but with the annoying equations to solve here. Okay, the second caveat leads to the construction of another theory, the so-called Galileon, and this is neither of my collaborators, this is Galileo, okay? The second caveat is the following. So, at least classically, then we're going to address quantum mechanics later, but at least classically, the problem with higher derivative terms is a problem in the equations of motion. So you don't want to have higher derivative equations of motion. You don't want to have equations of motion that involve more than two derivatives per field, okay? So the question is, whereas our theorem, our no-go theorem, relies on taking the Lagrangian at the lowest derivative level, okay? So there's a mismatch between the usual problem, which is at the level of the equations of motion, and the no-go theorem, which is assuming something at the level of Lagrangian. So the question is there a formally higher derivative Lagrangian that yields two derivative equations of motion? So let's assume, I mean, we can ask this question in more broader generality, but let's assume that we want to end up with a purely two derivative equation of motion. That is to say, I want the equation of motion. Sorry, now I'm calling pi the Lorentz invariant scalar, okay? Not just the fluctuations, but there's a mismatch in notation, just the full scalar. So I have a Lagrangian as a function of pi. This is not the fluctuation, this is the full scalar. And I want to study a generic Lorentz invariant Lagrangian of this scalar, okay, that yields two derivative equations of motion. So let me assume that the equations of motion are a nonlinear function of second derivatives of pi. So this can be a polynomial, for instance, like box pi plus box pi square, etc. Okay? I'm going to construct that Lagrangian later, but let me start from the equations of motion. So the equations of motion are trivially invariant under this shift. You shift pi by a constant, but if you also shift pi by a linear term, since the equations of motion only involves second derivatives, they are totally insensitive to this shift in pi. Okay? Now we call this Galilean invariance. Why? Because it's analogous to Galilean invariance of mechanics, in which you shift x of t by a constant plus a linear term in t. Okay? So if you want, Galilean mechanics has this property. Now, at the level of the Lagrangian, can we construct terms with this property that they give us purely two derivative terms in the equations of motion? Well, first of all, just by power counting, they should an nth order term should involve 2n minus 2 derivatives, okay? Because when I vary with respect to pi, I'm left with n minus 1 pi's, and I want two derivatives per pi. Okay, so just by power counting, I know how many derivatives I need. These are formally higher derivative terms in the sense that they have more than one derivative per pi, so they're not included in my theorem. And so perhaps I can get something useful out of this. Now, let's see a few examples. So the simplest of such terms is tadpole pi, n equal 1, 0 derivatives, equations of motion 1, which is a trivial function of second derivatives of pi. It's not very interesting. The next two simplest example is the kinetic term. Okay, the kinetic term is d pi squared. It corresponds to pi equal 2, sorry, to n equal 2. And in the equations of motion, it gives me box pi, which is a function of second derivatives of pi. The non-trivial, first non-trivial example is, I mean, it was found first in the four-dimensional effective description of the DGP model of modified gravity, but let's forget about modifications of gravity. It has this structure, d pi squared box pi. It is formally a higher derivative term. It has second derivatives here. But when you vary and get the equation of motion, you will notice that you get d mu d nu pi minus box pi squared. Okay, so once again, purely a function of second derivatives of pi. And you can keep going, and you notice that at the Lagrangian level, the invariance is there, the Galilean invariance, or the invariance under shifts of pi's and the first derivatives of pi, is there only upon integration by parts. Okay, so it's not an invariance of the Lagrangian, it's an invariance of the action. But that's enough to guarantee invariance of the equations of motion. Anyway, so you can ask what are the most general Galilean invariant terms, okay? And you can show that there is exactly one such invariant at each order in pi, okay? And in particular, any Galilean invariant term, apart from the tadpole, which has no derivatives, is going to be associated, is in one-to-one correspondence, to Cayley invariants of the matrix d mu d nu pi. Cayley invariants are like the determinant, the sum of subdeterminants, etc. Okay? So there are invariants, algebraic invariants you can construct with the matrix d mu d nu pi. Now, in d dimensions, the rank of d mu pi is d, so we just have d invariants, okay? You cannot have more than d invariants, plus the tadpole, which has nothing to do with the matrix of second derivatives. Tadpole is pi, but it's not very interesting. Okay? So let's check. In d equals 1 mechanics, the original Galilean invariant system, we have a linear potential, x, which in the equation of motion gives us a constant force, 1, which is clearly Galilean invariant, okay? And then we have the kinetic energy, x dot squared. And that's why in Galilean mechanics, we don't have derivative interactions of x, because they are not Galilean invariant. But in larger d, we can get non-trivial derivative interactions, okay? And in particular, for us, d equals 4, we have the tadpole, the kinetic energy, interactions up to a fifth-order interaction, okay? An interaction with 5 pi's and a bunch of derivatives, like 8, okay? And in particular, you can write down all these nice terms, and as we said, you have to stop at fifth order. Now, here we are using the notation in which capital pi is the matrix of second derivatives, and the brackets are the trace, okay? Those are the actual invariants, and they are the only Lagrangian terms you can write down that gives you purely second-order equations of motion. Okay? Yeah, I'm talking about here four space-time dimensions. Four space-time dimensions, we have the tadpole plus four more. Okay? Tadpole is not counting. It's extra because it has nothing to do with the matrix of second derivatives. Okay? Tadpole is always extra. Well, in 2D, you stop at the DGP invariant I wrote down earlier, d pi squared box pi. That's the last interaction that I found. Okay? Now, quantum mechanically, you can show that the Lagrangian also has nice properties, in the sense that this Galilean invariance is a symmetry, so it protects somewhat the structure of the Lagrangian. And also, you can check that thanks to Galilean invariance, it is consistent to have solutions that are deep in the nonlinear regime, so solutions that rely crucially on derivative interactions, without these leading to a breakdown of the effective theory. When I say it's consistent operationally, I mean this. Suppose you find the classical solution, and now you compute the size of loop corrections about it, and you check whether perturbations are weakly coupled, and you check that indeed this works. Okay? So here, in a sense, a Galilean invariance allows a disentangling between large classical nonlinearities and large quantum effects. They are somewhat two different regimes, okay? And you can go in the regime of large classical nonlinearities without this leading to large quantum effects. And so the natural question is, can the Galilean offer a new violation of the null energy condition? Okay, so this is work in progress, but we have some results, so I'd like to talk about them here. So let me summarize. We have a formally higher derivative Lagrangian, which has standard two derivative equations of motion. So there is no ghost pathology, and as I said, quantum mechanically, it's consistent to have strongly nonlinear solutions inside the effective theory. If you think about it, it's a similar statement to what you have for GR. You have huge nonlinearities in GR that are within the effective theory as long as curvatures are small. Okay? So there. Yes. It's positively definite. I'm going to tell you about stability in a second. But where all the stabilities, all the stability I'm worrying about here is always perturbative stability about some solution. So I don't know what happens beyond some barrier. But at least I can show that the solutions I'm interested in are always surrounded by barriers so that they are perturbatively stable. Okay? That's. Yeah. Of course, if you have a system that can violate the null energy condition, the Hamiltonian cannot be globally positive in any useful sense, okay? But at least you should worry that the system is metastable in the sense that it's perturbatively stable, which is perfectly fine, right? I mean, we are metastable with a lifetime of order 80 years. Ghost is a perturbative stability. It's nonlinear in the sense that it has to go through interactions, but it has to go through perturbative interactions. You don't need quantum tunneling. You just need perturbative interactions to see.
Okay, I see.
And develop the system. Okay?
So this background about which you're perturbing, is this supposed to be a non-dissipative kind of background? What background?
What do you mean by non-dissipative? I'm going to show you the solution in a second.
Oh, really?
Okay? Now here I'm just showing you that there are the ingredients to evade the Noether theorem. Yes?
What type of ultraviolet physics gives Galileo just effective?
Nothing. Yeah, as I'm going to comment later, it is probably motive Lorentz invariant in physics. So,
but once you have the Galilean, it's protected the structure by the symmetry and the normalization will flow.
What do you mean? Well, it's a normalized theory, so of course.
Yeah, but the operators that you induce.
Yes.
Do you still respect the Galileans?
Yes. Yes. Yes, they do. But let me go. Yeah, but there's no. We don't know the completion. So.
Is this the scalar analog of Lovelock gravity?
Well, that's a good question. We were thinking about that in particular. Since the first emergence of this is in the BGP effective action, we were thinking perhaps adding Lovelock gravity corrections to the higher dimensional BGP action, you can use these terms. But the answer is no, at least for BGP. So, in some sense, it's the analog, because also there you have standard two derivative equations of motion. But for instance, here you have more terms, right? Because in four dimensions, you have several terms. Whereas for Lovelock,
there's one per dimension.
Okay, so it has the features that make this a possible candidate for an exception to the Noether theorem. Now, indeed, there is an interesting stable null energy condition violating solution, cosmological solution, without instabilities and without supernormal expectations. Okay? When I say cosmological solution, once again, since I'm decoupling gravity, I just mean time-dependent solution. Then, if you reintroduce gravity, you can use this system to drive some interesting superaccelerating phase. Okay? So to get the solution, it is actually, we don't need this step, but to get the solution and study its properties very quickly, it's nicer to promote the Galilean transformations and the Poincaré invariants to the conformal group. Okay, so first of all, the number of generators is the same. Okay, and let me remind you the Galilean transformations of pi, they are invariants under a shift, and invariants under a shift of derivatives, that is to say, invariants under the linear shift. Okay? Now, if you, with a minor effort, you can replace this with the dilation, in which you shift pi, but you also dilate the argument, and special conformal transformations. Okay? Infinitesimal special conformal transformations, in which you shift pi by a linear thing, but you also change the argument by quadratic. Okay? So if you want, in other words, we're just saying treat pi as a dilatum. That is to say, consider the following fictitious metric in which pi appears at the exponential as a conformal factor. And now dilations and the special conformal transformations on the coordinates are going to act on pi like this. And you see that, in a sense, our original Galilean transformation is a limit of this, okay? In which it's a limit in a well-defined sense, okay? Anyway, so now constructing conformal invariant operators, it's very easy because you can use this fictitious metric, write down generic diff invariant operators for this fictitious metric, and those are automatically conformal invariant because the conformal group here defined is subgroup, the subgroup of diffs that leave the metric conformally flat, okay? Of course, you need to have to use higher derivative operators like Rμ, etc. Now, at every order in pi, there's a combination of them that corresponds to the Galilean invariant terms we talked about with exactly the same good properties. That is to say that at the, even though they look formally higher derivatives, they yield two derivative equations of motion. Now, why is this useful at all? Because the conformal group is so powerful as a symmetry that we can get solutions and properties of solutions there is. But no, it's not conformal invariant, but I can, by minor adjustments, I can make it conformal invariant. So the trivial one is the, according to my definition of how the conformal group acts on pi, the trivial one is d pi square now becomes e to the 2 pi d pi square, okay? Which for small pi is indistinguishable from this, but in general, if you want, this is a nonlinear, an even more nonlinear completion of my conformal invariant operators. And for every Galilean invariant term, there is. Sorry? No. No, because you see, d pi square. Yeah, but I have also a d pi square. So if I expand here, so the tuple comes from here, which is the square root of g of that fictitious metric.
Presented the complete set, but this new one is built out of a complete set that we had before.
Sorry, these are not Galilean invariant in the sense that now if I write the equations of motion are not going to be purely two derivatives. For instance, I'm going to have first derivatives in the equations of motion, etc. But I have at most two derivatives. So Galilean invariance is useful because the equations of motion are purely two derivative equations of motion. I don't have first derivatives in the equations of motion. So they are very nice it's very easy to construct them, okay? This promotion is nicer for constructing the interesting solutions I'm going to talk about. But they have the same good features, that they do not generate higher derivative equations of motion. But so, if you want, the fact that here I have a combination of the two should not concern you because these have different properties. They are not Galilean invariant, these ones. Okay?
But they are for small pi.
So, in a sense, Galilean invariance is the small pi limit of conformal invariance in this construction. Okay?
Are you literal there or are you schematic in that example? I would have thought you also need to conform a coupling to make it really conformal invariant.
Sorry, there's no gravity.
No, I know, but he used the trick, right? So it's Jim Nguyen with it to find it at Nguyen.
Yeah, but the metric is invariant.
So the curvature of that is not zero.
Sorry? I mean, the curvature is only coming from pi, right? So
yeah, sure, it would be additional. I thought it would be additional down.
Sorry, we're trying to refer to this. I mean, something like both pi into 2 pi.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yes.
Yeah. But upon integration by parts, I can rewrite it like this.
Cool.
Yeah, but the formula doesn't matter. Yeah. The Lagrangian is the term, but the deviation doesn't matter. Anyway, so why is this useful, this promotion to conform a group? Because we can now just think in terms of symmetry and very different. So, in particular, just by symmetry, we have a de Sitter-like solution. So once again, here there's no gravity, so it's just a useful terminology to call this de Sitter. Why do I call it de Sitter? Because the conformal factor e to the 2 pi is exactly the conformal factor of the Sitter space in conformally flat. Thank you for all this. And why is there such a solution? Well, because the de Sitter group is a subgroup of the conformal group, okay? So dilatant, any solution of the dilaton is going to be to break some of the conformal generators, and the three maximally symmetric solutions are going to be Minkowski for a constant dilaton, the Sitter for this, and anti-de Sitter for the same but with some special property. Okay, but just work in terms of symmetry makes the analysis very easy. Okay, so there's going to be such a solution. You can check from the equations of motion such a solution exists, and once again, just from symmetries, you can get the stress energy tensor of such solution. Scale invariance plus conservation of the mu immediately gives you this, that rho is equal to zero in such a solution, and that p is proportional to 1 over t to the 4. So here p runs from minus infinity to zero, okay? And so the question of the null energy condition now is a question about the sign of this thing here. Okay. If you can make this negative, then rho plus p is negative. And we have a solution that violates the energy condition. And then we have to check whether it's stable. And you can do it. And the answer is yes. Okay, so you can make that sign negative, have a solution that violates the energy condition for semi infinite time from t equal minus infinity to zero. Okay? And with no instabilities, once again, the action for fluctuations is totally constrained by symmetries because the original action is conformal invariant. The background solution breaks part of the conformal group down to the de Sitter group. So the action for fluctuations is going to be the de Sitter invariant. Okay? So the fluctuations see a fictitious de Sitter space. They live in a fictitious de Sitter space. Which means, first of all, that they are exactly luminal. Okay? So there's no superluminality here. And perhaps you can get excited and say, come on, there's also scale invariance because it's like inflation, so we're going to generate a spectrum of scale invariant de Sitter perturbations because technically, geometrically, the space is the same. Unfortunately, the answer is no to the second question because they are not massless scalars. Okay, the fluctuations, if you compute their mass, they are massive with a mass of order of this Hubble scale. Okay, and this, once again, you can get by doing zero computations, just by looking at the pattern of symmetry breaking. In particular, this is enforced by the fact that the background solution spontaneously break time translations, okay? And fluctuations are going to be the ghost of bosons of this breaking. And for when you break an internal symmetry, ghost of bosons are massless. When you break a space-type symmetry, the mass of the ghost of boson depends on how you are breaking the space-type symmetry. And in this particular case, you can check directly that the mass is going to be of order of the fictitious Hubble here. Okay, so in particular, if you compute the spectrum of perturbations in this solution, it's going to be very red. So it's not a realistic, at least in this minimal form, without introducing any new fields, etc., isocurvature perturbations, etc. This is not a realistic alternative to inflation. Okay, but still, I mean, just as a proof of an existent proof, if you now include gravity, at very early times, you have an H dot that scales like 1 over t to the 4, so H dot is 0 at t equal minus infinity and then grows, okay? Correspondingly, H goes like 1 over t cube. Of course, when H becomes of order of the fictitious H I have in my de Sitter solution,
gravitational back reaction is going to become important, and so the solution is going to change at rate times, but still you have a solution that accelerates from Minkowski and with no instability, and then evolves in a super accelerating universe. Okay? Solution will be modified at late times. If you check the scaling of the various terms in the Lagrangian, you'll notice that derivative interactions are going to grow at late times. Okay? And in at some point, you exit the effective thing. Okay? You get to a strong coupling regime, which perhaps you could identify as the region of the universe. Of course, there's no, I mean, this step is totally speculative because by definition, we don't have a theory to make the transition smooth. Okay? No. Well, yeah, it's really a T equal minus T, yes. Because you see, because in the past, that T is proper time. As long as you can neglect gravitational back reaction, that T is proper time. It's Minkowski time, because the space is really Minkowski. It's only at finite times that it becomes different from Minkowski. Okay? So let me conclude 1 minute with some final thoughts. So I presented two consistent effective field theories that violate the non-energy condition without instabilities. And in fact, by following the prescription Paolo very quickly mentioned yesterday, that is to say, if you're interested in cosmology and you have a cosmological solution A of T, you know that you're going to have a Goldstone boson associated with the spontaneous breaking of time translations, and you can write down the most generic action for that Goldstone boson, which is also constrained by symmetries, of course. Okay, that corresponds, by the way, to adiabatic perturbations at long wavelengths. And so, as long as you stick to 1 degree of freedom, that is to say, if that's all there is in the universe, in the sense there's no isocurvature perturbations, etc., you can show that the two only stable violations of the null energy condition you can have are exactly the ones you get by starting from the Gauss condensate or the Galileo. Okay? So in a sense, for cosmology with a single degree of freedom, these two effective theories are the only possibilities to violate the null energy condition in a consistent fashion. Okay? And in both cases, the null energy condition violating solutions do not have superluminal excitations. Still, the Gauss condensate is always in a phase of Lorentz, is always in a phase where Lorentz invariance is broken, in the sense that the restoring Lorentz invariance inevitably brings you outside the regime of the effective field theories. So there is no consistent Lorentz invariant phase for the Gauss condensate. Okay, so you might argue that perhaps this is an obstruction to the existence of a Lorentz invariant to the completion. Of course, this is not precise. I mean, it's just an idea. In the Galilean, it's even worse than that, because there are superluminal excitations for other solutions. So if you couple the Galilean to localize the sources and you study small perturbations about the solution you get, you discover that they are superluminal. Okay? So superluminality is not on the null energy condition violating solution, but it's somewhere else in field space, but still within the same effective theory. Okay? And also you can check that certain scattering amplitudes in the Galilean theory are too soft to obey the usual analyticity axioms of the S matrix. And so in a sense, for the Galilean, probably there is no standard Lorentz invariant to the completion, answering your question. Okay? And also there is this recurrent correction between violating our energy condition and superluminality, which in some cases is very sharp. Some other is quite loose. Okay? So in GR, as we said, the dominant energy condition, which is a closed cousin of the non-energy condition, is the statement that there is, in a sense, no superluminal flow, which is somewhat vague. A more precise statement is that if you don't have non-energy condition violating matter and you start from asymptotically flat space, you will not create closed time like curves. So this is not a statement about superluminality in the system that is violating the non-energy condition, but in the structure of space-time that system creates. So it's somewhat an indirect relation, but still quite sharp. In our Nogo theorem, at the lowest derivative level, the relation is super sharp, in the sense that if you have non-energy condition and stability, then you have superluminal, sorry, if you violate the non-energy condition, there's a things here. With a stable system, then you have superluminal excitation. For the Galilean, is quite loose. Certain solutions violate the non-energy condition in a stable fashion. Other solutions are superluminal. Okay? And the question is this connection between the non-energy condition and the speed of propagation deep, or is it accidental? Because it has different, it appears in different ways, at different level of sharpness, and I'm not sure what to make of it. Thank you.
So, one extreme case of the superluminality is pi dot, the coefficient of pi dot vanishes, but you still have gradient terms in your action.
Yes.
So what's wrong with that? Well, you say that those are the only possible stable examples. This example it doesn't look unstable to me. It's non-dynamical. The fluctuations of.
But for instance, are you sure that higher derivative corrections there are not important and they screw up the derivative expansion? Because there, if you have higher derivative corrections, they can give you higher derivatives in time, which is a problem because this is usually associated.
But if there are higher derivatives in time, that's a different question. So I don't know. But if there are just the first derivative, you can just solve this order by order. So it's a non-dynamical equation to first order, and you can keep solving it that way, order by order.
Because at second order, you'll have a ghost. I mean, kind of for the reason he said near the beginning.
Well, I mean, we're talking about instability, so I don't see.
Oh, yeah, but I'm talking about I'm talking about both instability and some basic consistency of the effective field in the sense that you want the derivative expansion to be well-defined, etc.
I mean, if you have a non-dynamical field, then it doesn't have an effective field theory. It's just a non-dynamical.
Well, but the problem is that once you include the higher derivative corrections, perhaps it becomes dynamical, and it becomes dynamical in a sick way. That's my concern. I don't know the specific example you're talking about, but
so that's the perturbative is a possibility. You're saying higher order terms might ruin this, but that's it. That depends on the higher order terms.
Yes, but the higher order terms are going to be there in general. Anyway, perhaps if you have some specific example.
So you get to your the Galilean.
Yeah. Yes.
So the Galilean theorem is by the Galilean effect, and that is the contraction of the
reciprocal. No, the contraction of the conformal group, SO4.
That's right.
Yes.
So I'm just thinking, what that give you. So you know that Galilean things you can from DGP leverage and decoupling limit and get to the interaction, like the Poincaré group. So is there any that very naively if you start with some higher mental thing where you have a yes?
Yeah, we did. We thought briefly about that, but we didn't come to any sensible conclusion. Yeah, there's vaguely this, vaguely it should work, but we were not able to do it. Exactly. We were not able to do it.
Okay, let's take over.